Using a sports metaphor, what happened is that I threw myself an assist, but it was a bit too long. And so at some point I decided that trying to run as fast as I could and risking to smash on the commercial boards at the end was not really worth it. So I have no real plan for today. it wasn't worth trying to squeeze new stuff in a couple of lectures yesterday and today. So I thought we can leave this day for questions or maybe even something new, but it would be kind of more informal rather than, like, I don't have an agenda. So that's the known plan for today. I should have done this yesterday. I wanted to remind you to complete surveys. So maybe at the end, I leave 10, 15 minutes. You can go grab your computer and do it. So we know it's done. That's useful for us to plan for next year. So it's great if you could write a few words. So yeah, it's a bit embarrassing to be recorded right now. Probably I would say that they don't put it online. okay.
Also, we can talk about Loop.
Yeah, sure. No, of course. That was the assist that I threw myself and I couldn't catch. I went a bit too long.
Yeah, just an overview of, just that if we hear the term spin foam or something that we get an idea what it is.
For sure.
So if something like that we can discuss.
Because important assumptions that we make in that area, like what is the different assumption that we have in loop gravity?
Mm-hmm.
It should be different than others, right?
Like, so, okay, very good. So I can give a few basic, that was kind of the plan, but wanted to hear from you as well. So the goal of loop quantum gravity could be summarized in the following way. One would like to write down a general covariant quantum theory. Whatever that means, that's what one wants to do. And the reasons, well, should be clear by now, because general covariance, we insisted so much, is really at the root of what GR is. So if you can merge general covariance and quantum mechanics, well, it's very hard, and you probably get very close to a theory of quantum gravity. And the goal is to try to do that without adding other things. It could be, it's an hypothesis. It's a working hypothesis. You don't want to, you try to do it in vacuum, but maybe matter is actually crucial to do it properly. So who knows? Like, it's just one attempt. So that then becomes quickly an attempt to build, it blends with the notion of building notions of quantum geometry. So in which sense we can talk about quantum geometry rather than classical geometry. So these things all merge, and depending on who you ask to, and they have slightly different takes on things. So it's also hard to give a broad view of the subject, because since it's not complete, of course, people like to focus on different angles, no? And then they give their own. Okay, so this is the broad picture. There is a class of theories which are general covariant and are quantized, but do not have local degrees of freedom, which are topological theories. So so spin foams, in a sense, can be seen as born out of topological field theories, and at the same trying to break some of the symmetries of the topological field theory to put back in local degrees of freedom. In doing so, of course, you also tend to make the theory much not very easy to analyze at that point. So this is always the trade-off, and here I want to emphasize one thing, which comes up, I would say, over and over again in different approaches, is that since symmetries and dynamics are so tightly related, it's super important to respect the symmetries, but it's also super hard. Because if you were able to do it properly, in a sense, you would have already quantized gravity. And usually solving, imposing these constraints to do it properly, it means knowing the solution space of GR, which is it's a nonlinear theory. It's a really, it's a not easy feat. So even in usual quantum field theories, what one does is to develop approximation schemes. So scattering amplitudes are perturbative in the sense that count a certain number of interactions, of loops, and so they perturb in that sense. Lattice field theory perturbs by cutting the truncating the number of degrees of freedom to those that live on a certain lattice, but they maintain non-perturbative aspects in the field sector. In gravity, these two things become one. You can, if you mirror on a lattice, you're cutting down, you're breaking your symmetries. And if you're perturbing on a background, you're also breaking your symmetries. And the two are, in a sense, tightly related. Yeah, so lattice, what it does is to say, instead of saying we have small fields and we kind of perturb in powers of the fields or some h-bar parameter, they're non-perturbative in that sense, but they can only, a lattice can only sustain a finite number of degrees of freedom because your space is reduced to points and lines. It's not a continuum object anymore. So you have your fields are associated maybe to each edge of the lattice, but now there are a finite number of them.
At least if the space is bounded.
Yeah, but even then, you are. It's not a continuum theory anymore. So it is still highly truncated. You go from an uncountable infinity to a countable one. So, and diffeomorphies really don't like being broken in either way. So that's kind of the big challenge. And this is a problem that comes up no matter what you try to do. And so it's really challenging to work in that direction. And this mixes with also the problem of maybe that's a bit too much. So let's try, however, to put down the basic ideas and work from there to see if there are questions. So first point to do a quantum theory is that you need a vacuum, and on this vacuum you add the excitation, and of course. Again, this way of thinking, however, as you can notice, is perturbative in a sense. You can add excitations off top of each other, but there are always a finite number of them. So already there, whether we are adding particles, whether we are adding lattice edges on the or something like that, it's always a discrete step that one is taking. So anyway, what is the vacuum that one considers in loop quantum gravity? Traditionally, in the tutorial, we have seen that we can express gravity instead of in the DM phase space in this connection electric fields way. So we have a EA, which are an SU2 electric field and an SU2 gauge potential. So this is the analog of HIJ because it's something that can allow you to compute areas. We have seen in the tutorial. So it's really, and in fact, from E, you can reconstruct H by E. It's like a tetrad, but it's a densitized inverse tetrad. So it contains all that information. Tetrad is space-time, four-dimension. Triad is 3D. Whereas this guy contains the extrinsic curvature. It's hidden in it. So now we have, so this is the relationship with ADM, and we have these extra SU2 symmetries, which is the local rotation symmetry, essentially. So that's why there is an SU2 here. The vacuum that one chooses is, if you want, there are different ways of writing it. Maybe you write it like this. Is the state of no geometry, of no metric. So in this vacuum state, there is no metric at all. It's not Minkowski. It's very far from Minkowski. It's a state in which is an electric vacuum, one could say. But if you look at what kind of geometric degrees of freedom the electric field is encoding are metric degrees of freedom. So in this state, wherever I measure length, there's nothing. There's just no space. So this is called sometimes the Ashtekar-Lewandowski vacuum, which is built in a more rigorous manner, but that's a main property it has. And it's a state of no geometry. So in a Schrödinger quantization, where E is roughly d over dA, is vacuum state E of A is just one. It's just a constant state, so that when I derive it, I get zero. So it's equally spread over all possible connections, of course, but has no geometry.
But you still have a manifold.
Well, it's a manifold without a metric on top. So it's you still need some. You still have a manifold in the sense, a topological manifold. Yeah, it's a topological manifold. And in fact, to build things properly, you're working, well, let's not. That would take us too far. But yes, you have a topological manifold.
Just what I meant is that even if you cannot measure distances, for instance, you can still define a notion of continuity.
Let's go there in a second. Let me come back to continuity in a second, because it's a curious point.
And when we do that, and just a side question that occurred to me, the induced metric from that topology doesn't have anything.
Sorry? I didn't hear.
The induced metric from the topology?
Oh, no. The topology is a set of, is a collection of open sets. So it has no notion of metric or no metric induced. Like, I don't know. I think there is a...
Well, you can always induce a sort of distance measure. Like, not, I suppose, not in the G sense, but you can measure distances.
No, you cannot. I don't think you can associate numbers to pairs of points or something. You can say which ones are, in a sense, close, but it's a much more abstract notion of closeness. So, so this is our vacuum, and now we want to start adding excitations on this vacuum. Let me just say before, because we will not come back to that anymore, why not the vacuum A equals zero, right? So there are some theorems that say that there are some properties that single this one out, but some of them are not so cogent, in a sense. They're more technical than actual physically relevant. So if you try to weaken them, and you have to understand how to do it, but it's possible, you can talk about an A equals zero vacuum, except that A is not a gauge invariant quantity. So A equals zero doesn't make any sense. what would be the correct analog of that?
The expectation value of the operator.
Which operator captures a connection? So we have an electric field. The other one would be a magnetic field. So that's the gauge, covariant, at least, object that we can set to zero properly. And this is the curvature of A. So we have one vacuum, the electric vacuum, and the magnetic vacuum would be so one for which this is zero. And in fact, maybe I'll come back to this later if that's the direction things are taking. This is the physical vacuum in 3D gravity. So in 3D gravity, you can start from this one, add excitations until you solve all the constraints. And this is the state that you would create. So so this is an alternative magnetic vacuum. And there are a few subtleties, which I'm not going into, but if you're familiar with condensed matter, on a lattice, E is like an edge operator, and these are Plaquette's operator, phase operators on the lattice, and you can decide which one to go in, like you have stated. Okay, so now, what kind of excitations do we have? So let's stick to this representation here. We have what we want to, the easiest thing to do is to act by multiplication by A. Again, A is not a nice gauge invariant object. So if you want to do things properly, we need to find something that is nicely covariant under our symmetries that we can build an object with and then apply to this vacuum. So the zero level or observable, if you want, or operator in this case, is a Wilson line. So what is a Wilson line? We have our manifold sigma, which has no metric on it, as I said. It's just an abstract topological manifold. And on this one, I select some path gamma. And on this path gamma, what I do is to build let me do it in steps. So I build first let's see how much this needs to be unpacked. So the path order exponential of A along gamma gives me it's called the holonomy of A on along gamma. So how clear is this? Not very much. Good. OK. So the idea is quite simple. So in the abelian case, let's look at the abelian case first, because it's much more intuitive. So in the abelian case, I have a connection, a potential AI DXI, and this goes under a gauge transformation. Let's do it like this. Is sent into AI plus DI Xi. Now, this guy doesn't transform homogeneously and is a one form. So what it really is asking for is to be integrated along a line. One forms are, if I write them like this, it's quite clear that they want to be integrated on a line. So a line is what? Gamma is a function from 0 to 1 into my manifold. Call it sigma. So it's sending
The curve is it closed?
Well, for now it does. It's not important. At the end, later I will close it or not. For this is more general. I'm being but thanks. I'm not imposing that gamma zero is equal to gamma one. Otherwise, would be from the circle to sigma would be a nicer way to write. Okay, so this is gamma, and integrating A along gamma does the following. So I can write AI D gamma I over DS, DS, right? So this is, and I write this symbolically like this. This is the integral along gamma of A. So if you want, there are two ways of thinking about this. Maybe the simplest is that I'm pulling back A on gamma. I have a one form on a one manifold, and this is just the its integral. This is how I would write it in coordinates. So S is a parameter along my curve. This is the velocity of the curve with respect to that parameter. And you can check that this is, in, if I change the parametrization, the cancels out. It's well defined. Now, how does this guy transform under gauge transformations? Well, A gets an exact term. So it will go in the same guy plus x final minus x initial. So let's say at 0 minus, at 1 minus 0. Is it like this is just Stokes? The integral of a derivative is the difference of the values. Okay, so we're almost there. So this is also not so nice because it's a it's a sum. But what happens if I take the exponential of this? Then this object, it's nice because you see A wants to be valued in the Lie algebra, so this will be valued in the group. So it's a group element now, and it transforms. The abelian group is commutative, so I don't really care, but it goes into C xi gamma 1 e to the a e to the xi gamma 0 minus. So it looks a bit like a conjugation, except that on one side I have the final point, and on the other side I have the initial point. So from the perspective of my of a drawing, what is happening is that I call this h gamma of a. So this is what I call there, the analog of what I call there h gamma of a. And this transforms, doesn't care what kind of gauge transformation I'm doing along the path. It just cares about the initial and final gauge transformation. So I have G equal to, usually one calls this the source and target. So that's a common way of talking about these things. So there is just, these are what enters this transformation. So this is G target, H gamma, G source minus. So in this is a nice covariant object. Of course, if I'm doing things in the non-abelian theory, this would not really be good enough. So this is what makes it work. So this path order exponential just means that H is the solution to the following equation. So suppose you know H. How do you compute A? So suppose I know H up to a certain point here. So I call this H up to S, no? From 0. So H at 0 is just the identity. Because I haven't gone anywhere, I haven't, so I want it to be the exponential of 0, which is 1. And then I keep going, no? So I call these up to point, the point S, until I get to one in the end. So what I know is that if I derive ds h up to that point, and so let's see which direction it's going. What do I find? I find that this will be right? It's an exponential, so a comes down. Now, this can be written a bit more nicely if I multiply by h minus 1. Just, and we're almost there. So now we have an equation that generalizes nicely to the non-abelian case. Oops. So ds h gamma up to the point s is equal to a. So if you look at this formula, this is an element of the Lie algebra, and this is also an element of the, so this computed at gamma s. And so this is a first order equation. For this h, which is valued in the group, h at gamma s is a function on the group, or it's valued in the group. So whatever the solution of this equation is, I call it the path order exponential, because it's like the abelian exponential, but in fact, it's a bit like time order products. The time order exponential that you probably saw in field theory is the same idea. You can build it recursively by integrating up to a certain point and nesting the integrals. You can formally write down a solution of this equation in the very same way. So that's why it's called path order. Like it's always the same thing, but just I will not try to remember how to write that recursive formula, but there is one. So essentially, this h is the parallel transport, if you want, is the object encoding parallel transports of object along that curve. That's what it's doing. Because for every small step, it's adding a e to the a delta x. So it's essentially this product, the limit of this product. Okay, so this. And then one can show that under a gauge transformation, this holonomy goes into G target H G source minus 1. So whatever I'm doing in my, whatever gauge transformation I'm applying to A, so A goes to g minus 1 a g minus 1 dg. Things are written in such a way. Yeah, maybe my conventions are, maybe I should write it like this to make it look a bit more similar. So this is what one would find for h. So the path ordering takes care of these inhomogeneous pieces. Yeah.
Maybe you'll go there, but just like when you brought up Wilson Light, and in the beginning you had said topological field theories. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you're going to connect the two, but you know, is this then going to be like a quantized quantity that is?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
You know, maybe an integer or something. That's
no, we're not necessarily trying to. Okay, yes, let me get there. So what happens? So what happens if I'm in this vacuum over here? In the magnetic vacuum, let's look at the abelian case. The integral of A on a curve is the integral of f on the disk. So all these h's are trivial, because if there's no curvature, all holonomies are just one. And the reason is that is by Stokes' theorem, f is just the a. And so this construction is such that that result generalizes to the non-abelian case. So in the magnetic vacuum, all holonomies are just one. It's just a different way to encode flatness. Now, there is...
Interesting, because you're saying, when is it zero if there's no curvature, which doesn't make sense, but usually you say, right, when is it zero, that's a property of the manifold.
Well, it's a prop.
I don't know. It was just a funny picture I had in my mind now, because you literally said curvature instead of like holes.
Yeah. So here is is the curvature of A, and we now, if you are able to relate A to some geometric property, then you can think of that as the curvature of the manifold in the GR sense, but a priori here is the curvature of the magnetic field. So the curvature of A is the magnetic field in some sense. So it depends. So here I kind of switch between gravitational and gauge theory language, because I have that, I can do it thanks to that, that mapping that I did. So now I can sort of forget the gravitation interpretation for a while. And go back to it later. I just work as if I had a gauge theory. So there is a nice theorem that generalizes this thing. I said, if all H's are the identity for all possible gammas, then I'm in the magnetic vacuum. I can generalize this and say that if I know all possible holonomies, then I know the connection everywhere. I know my state everywhere. So. And this is the starting point of loop quantum gravity. Loops refer to these Wilson loops. So if I, idea, knowing all the value of all H gamma A for all possible gammas, I went a bit too fast. Here I did it open for the open loop. When I say that they are all one, it's just for the closed loop, right? Because I need to use Stokes, so it needs to be a closed loop. So I just wanted to close that gap. And if it's closed, this transforms under conjugation at the source point. So I just choose a random point on my loop, and this is so. It's just conjugation up to at this base point. So, for example, the trace would be a gauge invariant object, a gauge invariant quantity. So, if I know this for all gamma closed, it can be closed. So they are gauge invariant. In this sense that if I take the trace, I get a gauge invariant object. If I know all of them, then I know I can reconstruct A of X. I can basically reconstruct A at every point. Of course, not quite A, but just the gauge invariant content of A. No, is what I care. And so once I have A everywhere, I have my state potentially, no, my quantum state, which is just a function of A. If I can say which weight I'm giving to each A, I know my quantum state. So if I know which weight I'm giving to every loop, I can I know my state, my so. This becomes psi 0 of A can be written as psi, well, not necessarily zero, sorry. Psi of A can be written as a psi of gamma, in a sense, no? Instead of using A as a basis, I use the loops as a basis. So this is called the loop transform, and is the way loop quantum gravity was born in. It is the basic idea that gives the name of to the theory. So you can think of these gammas as the Faraday lines of the magnetic field, but it's the special magnetic field that has a geometric interpretation. So instead of thinking about the magnetic field as a field point by point, I think of it as coming in these lines, or already organized through these lines. And I'm giving a weight to different configurations of these Faraday lines. That's a way, a pictorial way of thinking. So the easy, yeah.
Do we ever consider the curvature of, the curvature of the electric field? But
no, the electric field is already.
Yeah. Okay.
It's already a covariant object, so it's the curvature. You take it because A is non-covariant, so you need to. It's a magnetic potential. So it's a potential. So the actual object is the magnetic field, whereas E is already the object. So now, for example, let's look at the simplest state that I sort of depicted there. What happens if I act on my magnet? I can act on the vacuum. On my electric vacuum with this one state that I drew up there. So this becomes
So excitations are having more loops, right?
Maybe I should sorry?
Excitation means we have more loops, right? If I add
So here I'm adding just one. So I can think of this as a fact. I was trying to think of what is the, because it's not really the basis one uses. So I need to think how to write it. But this is just the vacuum is one. So I can think of this as acting as a creation operator for this loop, because it just acts by multiplication. And now this is just a function of A, no? So what happens now? I can ask what kind of geometry. So this is some, and I interpret this as some psi gamma of A. So is the one excited state with this loop excited on this vacuum where there is no geometry anywhere. Now I'm exciting one loop. Now I can ask, is there any geometry on this state? Before I go there, I want to, I see some perplexed faces. So let's try to clean this up before.
I can ask something. I think the final state that we completely know the metric is when we have all of loops. So it's kind of coming from no geometry by adding one by one loops to going to a state that completely know
the that's a wish.
And in this transition,
yes.
We don't have geometry. We just have some, I don't know, distance along these loops. So.
Mm-hmm. They are very singular. They're very singular, right? So, but this is kind of always the case. If you think about the Fock space, you're adding one plane wave at the time. It's very hard. You need infinitely many of them to recover as they're already smooth, but if you have in mind some field configuration, you need to add infinitely many Fock states to recover it. This wave packets kind of idea, no? And or if you're on a lattice, you need to refine your lattice infinitely to recover any smooth. So this problem is also present in those situations to an extent if you read it properly. So here is similar. But of course, it's a bit worse, maybe, because you don't have a smooth space-time until you have added infinitely many of them. and that's very hard to control. So definitely, Minkowski state in this picture would be an extremely highly excited state in this sense, it's kind of a, I don't know, in condensed matter parlance, one could say maybe a condensate of these excitations, in the sense that there are so many that they are indistinguishable. Probably you need some kind of phase transition, a continuum phase transition happening, or something of that sort. But you can approximate Minkowski in some sense by using a large but finite number of these, but you will never be sure it's actually. It's a bit like the lattice picture of a continuum configuration. But yeah.
So we have this gauge theory, and this gauge theory has a Hamiltonian, right? What's the ground state of this Hamiltonian?
So if I had Young Mills, the Hamiltonian would look like roughly E squared plus F squared. And so one can see that the ground state will be a Gaussian when written in terms of E or A or something like that, roughly. So this Gaussian, of course, it's very far from this state, which is a constant. So it's quite, so to get it, I need to pile up infinitely many excitations. In gravity, H is rather, we didn't write it down, but is the Hamiltonian constraint. So in these variables, it's schematically is F E E with all the indices contracted. So I have IJ, IJ, A, B, C, epsilon, A, B, C. This is SU2 epsilon, more or less. There are other decorations, but I will not write them. So one needs to go to the ground state of this. And which operator ordering you choose is also important. Because if I put F to the right, for example, then this state would be part of, would be one ground state, like would be one physical state of this Hamiltonian. And you need to set this, to zero. So here you have a spectrum. Here, the only physical value is zero.
But isn't that a, so in, like in the ADM language instead, Minkowski is the ground state.
It's very tricky to talk about ground states in gravity. The Hamiltonian is not even positive definite. Right? Okay, I'm not saying it. The point is that it's a very different problem to solving GR dynamics rather than the dynamics of a theory on a background. So it's not quite the ground state, even in ADM.
You're right. I guess I was confused because I was imagining, I was thinking about the case when sigma is not compact. And so we have like an ADM mass.
Oh, okay. If you have boundaries, sure. If you have boundaries, the business are.
Can loop quantum gravity handle topological manifolds with boundary?
I don't know in the canonical how to do it, but just because I never really thought, and maybe there are people who did it. But in the spin foam picture, boundaries are actually there from the start. But since everything is discrete, notion like the ADM mass and so on, which require, remember, ADM requires boundary conditions, because you are saying things go to Minkowski at infinity, and that's what allows you to do all those things. So implementing those kind of boundary conditions that allow you to restrict the problem to a subset of field configurations where the energy functional is actually positive, definite, and so on and so forth. That's super tricky, because you see you are adding something which you know from the continuum, and you want to add it onto something that is of this kind, like super singular and non-perturbative. So it's a very wide gap to bridge. So those things are really hard. But ideally, for sure, one would want to impose boundary conditions, maybe find a positive Hamiltonian. But it's these are hard problem that people are looking into, but it's work in progress. I don't have a definitive answer.
I guess I'm also still a bit confused about featuring Minkowski as a highly excited state.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm just saying, okay, we have this big vacuum, and then the first thing we do is in very local regions, we just create space-time. Like, we need to make something first, be there. And then we start curving that something once it's there, locally. And we build up slowly, step by step, all these little patches of something that gets a bit curved, and eventually we'll get to something excited. But in that picture, Minkowski to me sounds like just doing the first step of just creating something, but not curving it.
There's no, so from this perspective, there's not a ton of difference between Minkowski and other states. It's not very clear from this closed universe canonical perspective, where closed is important. So there are no boundaries here. So it's not Minkowski out to infinity, and I'm looking at asymptotically flat things. This is what Charlie was asking. And that's really hard to deal with because of the boundary condition problem. Here we are thinking about a closed universe. And in a sense, there's no preference state. The GR Hamiltonian doesn't pick out one state as the ground state of that situation. All states are, or physical states, are H equal to zero. Because this is like a gauge constraint. So we're again to you start seeing why things are very different from a usual theory. You start.
It's like only ground states.
It's
like only ground states.
It's if you want highly degenerate, and there are plenty of them. But they're not even ground states in the sense that you cannot add an excitation that takes you out of there. So it's just not maybe the right way of thinking about those.
But this vacuum is a purely mathematical thing. Or do you think?
So these vacuums that I'm using is called a kinematical vacuum, will not be the physical state. So it's a starting point to build up things. And it's comfortable because it's at least formally satisfies everything, but is also kind of uninteresting because it has if f equal to zero, so maybe it does satisfy these up to operator orderings problems, which are important, but also complicated. It's gauge is diffeomorphism invariant because there's just nothing. And so it checks all the boxes, but is also completely crazy state from a geometry perspective. But also one has to keep in mind that, and now I will say, well, I want to get there in a moment before concluding to give the main, well, one of the main features, but here, H and K, so we have intrinsic and extrinsic geometry of each slice. And we cannot peak at the same time on both. So if we have a well-defined 3D geometry, it has a completely spread extrinsic curvature. So it means that we don't know much about space-time, how it will evolve into a space-time. So a state like Minkowski is, in a sense, a coherent state, which is optimally, like this is the best one can hope, optimally peaked on both H and K. So it's kind of a Gaussian state for both H and K. Morally, I don't know how to build that, but that's, in that sense, here I'm starting from these coherent states are, from the point of view of the creation and annihilation operators, have infinitely many things inside them. You build them by exponentiating the creation and annihilation operators. So this is where this must necessarily go. So in that sense, any geometry that has a resemblance of something semi-classical must be like an infinitely piled up of these basic excitations, like coherent states are in quantum mechanics, not even field theory, quantum.
So I just want to make sure I understand this too. Like, the weak force is also SU2, right? But it's the thing that's really different between them in some sense is just the Hamiltonian.
What is the main?
Is that like the main? Are there any other differences you can think of?
I mean, on the if you put them on the lattice or on a graph more generally, the kinematical phase spaces look the same. So I would say, yeah, the way you treat the Hamiltonian and the symmetries and interpretation you give to the object. But the mathematics of building the kinematical phase space, they are actually the same. That's why up to subtleties that I will. So it's similar to the lattice, but now how you interpret this lattice is very different, one case and the other. So formally they're similar, but if you look at the details, the interpretations differ. But the mathematics doesn't care about the interpretation, so there are lots of things in common. So here, let me just try to figure out what kind of geometry this guy carries. So to do that, we want to see, we know that E is kind of D over DA, roughly. But I want to be a bit more precise. So, and we see that since this is supported just on gamma, this will be a singular or something, no? So here we, let's try to be a bit more precise. So here we smeared A over gamma to build this excitation. So E now, remember from the tutorial, E computes areas and is nicely smeared on surfaces instead of lines. So there was a formula to be proven that E is like E wedge E, right? You remember? I will not put indices, but just, so this is the 3D triad, which means that EE is like H. So delta EE is like H. Not the four-dimensional one. Here we are really on a slice. So E, the way to build, I can build a surface operator, a geometric operator, which I call the area of the surface, by integrating basically E on the surface. Again, a bit sketchy, but that's a basic idea. Now, what is if I go and look at the symplectic structure, what I find is that this is E dA, which is basically something like this. Well, let's write omega. So if these, since there are wedges, if this is in direction 3, this will be direction 1 and 2. So it means that if my A is along the direction 3 in that direction, the conjugate variables must be on a transverse, in the transverse direction, because of these wedges, essentially. So now, thinking instead of A and E, I think in terms of gammas and surfaces, which are the dual objects, they need to cross transversally. So doing things properly, one discovers, and from this shouldn't be too surprising, is that this excitation is essentially giving an area to any surface that is pierced by that. So write that Wilson line, because I need them to intersect for them to be conjugate to each other. So I can think of these three integral as a one integral over gamma and a integral over S. So I find that at the discrete level, H is conjugate to here I should have called it the flux. That would be best. I don't want the RF yet. So X is the integral of E, so it's the flux, is the electric flux through S of E. And now is equal to either 0 if gamma does not intersect S, or it's and these formulas tend to be not so pretty, but in this situation it's not too hard. So let's say that H starts at S. So this is, remember, this we have A tau A is valued in the Lie algebra. So essentially we have XA here. Well, alpha, what were we calling them? Alphas? So the one that I want to look is like this, and this one gives me H gamma A tau alpha. If gamma intersects S transversally, the intersection should be transverse, but otherwise it's singular in a way. But so this is a bit like saying that these two are conjugate quantity is the best you can get, because this is group valued, so it's like an exponential. So when you derive it, you get it plus n one. No, so since this is an exponential, so let's in the abelian case, this would be something like that. It's clear that this gives this times 1, right? E, because it derives that. So here is the analog. That's why there is an H, because it's secretly an exponential, this thing. So it's not, this should not be surprising. And here this tau is basically telling you in which direction this is pointing. So that's the origin of the various terms. So since we have this bracket, we know that quantum mechanically, E and H, so if you apply E, S, well, X, the quantization of this flux over my excited state, like this, we get 0 if they do not intersect. So there is no area for any surface that does not intersect gamma, and the surfaces that do intersect gamma gets an area, gets something if this is different from 0. Now this something is at this level just the derivative of this, but one can look at the spectrum of this operator. It's not really worth trying to write this at this level, but if I find, instead of using H, I can change bases in a way that these operators are diagonalized. So this is an extra step that one should do. And what one finds out is that if one focuses on the area, so the area of S should be a SU2 invariant. Well, is, not should be, is an SU2 invariant. Um, So in fact, there are not so many. They are just the Casimirs of SU2, right? So it turns out that the area is proportional to the Casimir. So we get the spectrum, which is JJ plus. So if we want to, well, maybe it's a bit late to try to sketch how this is derived. So Casimir is just the J square, right? Is the J is not invariant itself, but J square is, and its spectrum is J plus one. Well, that depends what. So this is the area spectrum. Area spectrum is given by J, where J are half integers. So there is a minimal area. Turns out like this, that there is an area gap, is called, which is when the smallest area you can excite is square root of 3/2 or something. Square root of 3, yeah, half, with the half out. And usually there was this gamma that we saw in the tutorial that also, if you put it back in and you follow it, is just in front of it. And if you look at our units, so let's write everything. Yeah, that where kappa, the unit I've used along the entire course, where 8 pi g is equal to 1. Here there is also an h bar. So this kappa is our Planck scale in my conventions, and gamma is just in front of it, is this Barbero-Mirzi parameter, which is a part of the, it comes out in full generality if I try to quantize the, to build these SU2 phase spaces. And yeah, there is a minimal area. So that's how it comes about. So here I've gone a little fast, but I think the basic steps are what kind of vacuum we are starting with, which is this weird singular, like no geometry object. I can act on with certain creation and annihilation, like creation operators that create these loops. And this loop give geometry to whatever surface intersect them. So if you can imagine, if you have a lot of them, any surface gets a slightly different amount of geometry. Here we're just looked at one, so it's, of course, it's super singular. And how much area does it give? Well, H is not quite the right, a nice basis in the sense that it doesn't diagonalize the area operator, but I can find a basis that does by doing a Fourier transform on the group, essentially. I don't know if you know about Peter Weyl theorem, stuff like this. You just write these in representations of SU2 rather than, so going to the representation is like doing a Fourier transform in some sense over the group. So each representation J now diagonalizes my area. And roughly, the reason is that everything has to be rotation invariant. So, and here we are working with SU. So it's this Casimir of SU2. There are not many choices, in fact. And this is how I went. Yeah?
Every time I hear about spin forms, I associate the first part of the word spins to SU2.
Which is exactly what this spin is, yes.
So we have areas, we quantize areas, we have a smallest area over there. And these areas somehow satisfy an SU2 algebra the way that we kind of The second part, this to the Wheeler sense of a quantum foam, like a quantum geometry that has no definite topology, perhaps, and things like that. So is this part associated to this Astika Lewandowski state of no geometry?
So spin foam are a four-dimensional version of this, but the foamy part is basically because you can think of stacking lots of these loops. So in this case, more than a foam, which is built out of surfaces in a sense that intersect, here, since we are in one dimension less, we have just lines. So the if you want, if you take your foam, which is a set of bubbles, of surfaces, no, and you cut it on a slice, you will find a set of intersecting loops. As the, can you see that?
No.
Exactly,
but I can picture it.
So, but if you like in a three-dimensional foam, like a bubble, like a soap foam, is a set of literal spheres, bubbles, like with surfaces intersecting. And if I take a slice of that, I find a set of lines intersecting each other, no? So here is the same thing. Those lines are the cuts of the foam walls in the spin of what you call the spin foam. So when you once I excite lots of those gammas, they intersect and they form this graph. And that graph is a section of the foam, of the spin foam. So here we have a spin graph, which is called the spin network. So spin network is when I excite lots of those gamma that intersect each other and is a slice of a spin foam, which is for the like the history of spin networks growing and changing.
But here, in spin foam, it's still we're still talking about total 4D, right? Which here we have taken as time slice.
So this is the Hamiltonian picture. The spin foam tries to make it covariant, so you sum over histories in a sense, and you're summing over the foams instead of picking a spin network. So yeah, thanks for that. So. Okay, thank you.